This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Now and then you'll read a news story about a business executive, journalist, or aid worker being kidnapped in a third world country. But our guest, journalist Nicholas Schmidl, says such kidnappings occur thousands of times every year. It's become so common, in fact, that an industry of insurance specialists and kidnapping and ransom consultants has grown up to service companies whose employees are seized by rebel groups or criminals looking for a payday. In a piece in the New York Times Sunday Magazine, Schmidl notes that kidnapping consultants have made bargaining, ransom, and the release of hostages almost routine. Some people wonder whether their willingness to negotiate and pay only makes the problem worse. Nicholas Schmidl is a fellow at the New America Foundation and a frequent contributor to the Times Magazine. He's also written a book about his experience living and reporting in Pakistan. It's called To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years in Pakistan. Schmidl spoke to Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Nicholas Schmidl, welcome to Fresh Air. Your story in this week's New York Times Magazine begins with a Scottish gentleman who's a veteran worker in the oil industry at a karaoke bar in Nigeria when a bunch of armed men storm through the door, order everyone to the floor, and he is whisked away in a van and becomes a victim of kidnapping. Now, were the motives of his kidnappers financial or political or both?
A little bit of both. When John was kidnapped, at first he thought that these people that had bartered to the door were armed robbers. That was the most common form of crime that would happen in such an establishment. So they all told him to get down, and all these people are laying on the floor. And as they started combing through the crowd, there were, you know, no one knows exactly how many gunmen, maybe 8, maybe 12, because there were some that were also out in the vans waiting outside. As they were combing through the crowd, they started, some of them were picking out, taking watches off of those that were lying on the ground, while the others were talking purely political rhetoric and talking about what they were doing and, you know, wanting to know who people were. But John said that what let him know that these people were different was the way that they were pushing them into the van and that they were very careful. They realized that these people were commodities. And they realized that the people that they were about to kidnap were going to be used as political pawns, and they were also, in the end, also going to be used as financial pawns, and they needed them to be in as good of a shape and as unharmed as possible.
Now, your story really is about some of the financial superstructure that has developed around the industry of kidnapping and ransom. Speaking internationally, how common is this? I mean, are there scores, hundreds, thousands every year?
There are certainly thousands. There were last year in Mexico alone, there were 7,000 cases, reported cases of kidnapping. In Nigeria last year, there were about 450. And you know, so Mexico is by far and away the industry leader, if you will.
Of these thousands of kidnappings, does anybody have an estimate of how many are ideologically motivated or how many of them are simply cash transactions?
It increasingly is purely a business transaction. Now, in different countries, the nature of the kidnappings differs. In Nigeria, very few instances involve the victims being hurt or killed. In Mexico, there are reports that, you know, once someone is taken, fingers start getting cut off if the ransoms aren't paid in due time. And it's a much, much, much different different industry, if you will, a different business. So Nigeria, though, it really is all about the dollars. And particularly in the case of the foreign oil workers, I mean, John was telling me this, the Scottish guy was telling me these great stories, you know, of them once they were in the camp, once they had been kidnapped and were taken into the creeks and were being held at this camp where the kidnappers were, you know, they were ordering them takeout and they were then asking them what they wanted on their hamburgers and then they were getting in the boats and driving into the middle of Port Harcourt with a takeout order, ordering the takeout, throwing it in the bag, getting back in the boats and then driving back to the creeks to make sure that their 6 foreign hostages were happy and, you know, were relatively well-nourished.
Now, you write about the institutions that have grown up around these increasing numbers of kidnappings for ransom. There are, of course, insurance companies that write policies for firms that have employees at risk. And then there are these kidnapping and ransom consultants. What do they do?
The kidnapping ransom consultants are essentially advisors. So if a company, say Acme Company, wants to buy a kidnapping and ransom insurance policy, they will go to an insurance company, they will buy the policy, and then with that policy will come the stipulation that you are going to get a kidnapping and ransom consultant that should there be, he or she is not only going to advise on the front end about how to prevent kidnappings, but in the instance or the event of a kidnapping, will be on the scene with you, advising you and walking you through the negotiation process.
So it's to effectively negotiate release in a fiscally responsible manner?
Exactly. The biggest thing that these K&R consultants bring is they bring a world of historical and institutional knowledge. They know what an American who works for an oil company, what the ransom is in Nigeria, how that differs from, say, a Canadian journalist who's been kidnapped in Somalia, and how that differs from a British executive who's kidnapped in India or something. I mean, they draft what's called a target settlement figure. And that is essentially the K&R consultant's operating budget, how long they think it'll take, how much they think the ransoms will be, how much it's going to cost them to stay. So the policies cover everything. They're reimbursable policies. Now, the media also plays a major role. And one of these K&R consultants who'd spent a lot of time doing cases off the coast of piracy cases in Somalia said, look, CNN always gets the ransoms wrong. So these pirates come to us and they say, look, we saw the last ransom that was paid for a boat down in the Gulf of Aden or something. And CNN says they paid $10 million. And this guy, said, well, CNN's always wrong. It was, in fact, closer to $1 million. And so we can sort of revise the whole negotiation.
Hmm. Now, to what extent from your reporting do the police seriously try and investigate kidnappings or prevent them? Or to what extent are they in collusion with the kidnappers?
According to the police, it's pure investigation, no collusion whatsoever. According to the kidnappers and according to the local journalists and according to human rights lawyers, they depend upon one another. Idi Ali Nwezi, who was one of the most wanted kidnappers in Port Harcourt this spring, we had numerous meetings with this guy over the phone, in person, and he and his lawyer detailed the extent to which Idi Ali, after he would get a ransom, he would then pay back the police chief. He would give the police chief cars. He would give the police chief money. And in other cases, they would sort of alert the police ahead of time to, look, we're gonna do this kidnapping on this street at this time. Stay off the roads. So the relationship is frighteningly scary.
So a kidnapper told you directly, I was working with the police chief. He would clear the roads when I needed them, and he got his cut.
He went one step further. He said that the police chief's wife was, in fact, driving a car that I had bought with ransom money and donated to the police chief as a way of saying thank you.
Did you get back to the police chief and ask him about this?
Yes, I did. I talked to him a few weeks ago, and he said that it was a factual impossibility.
Tell us what happened to John, the guy that you wrote about who was kidnapped in Nigeria and taken away to this camp and given takeout orders by his captors.
Right. So John, the first morning that John woke up in the camp, he noticed that he gets into the camp on the first night, and they go through and they ask. The kidnappers didn't know who they had. They knew they had pulled six people off the ground in a bar. They didn't know who they had, so they went through and all of these guys named gave their name, their company affiliation, and their nationality. They went to sleep that night. The next morning they woke up, and the kidnappers that had brought in all this local labor, and they were putting together huts, and they were, they were cooking food. And John was saying that there are all these rumors and all these suspicions that cannibalism takes place back in these creeks. And John said, look, I don't know, and I don't know whether these guys were just trying to mess with us or get us into our head, but he was sitting on a bench in the camp one day. And one of the kidnappers next to him looked at John and he said, Oibo. And Oibo is the word in Nigeria for white man. And he said, Oibo. And he looked at John and he kind of scanned him and looked him up and down. And he said, good chop, good chop. And chop is the word for food and sort of in the pidgin English they speak, suggesting that, white men make particularly good food. So this went on for about 9 days. And on the ninth day, John was told to put on the kidnappers, the leader of the kidnapping gang in this camp came up to John and said, put on these clothes. And he handed him a ski mask, gloves, hat, camouflage pants, etc. He put all the gear on, and by this point he looked just like the rest of the kidnappers. And they got into a speedboat and they went racing off. And they drove for about 15 minutes in the water, in the river, and they eventually landed at a spit of sand. And there were three guys sitting on the beach. One of them handed John a phone and said, "John, we're gonna make a call right now, and you're gonna be asked two proof of life questions." And the proof of life is really the crux of the negotiation. And that is when the kidnappers and the negotiators can prove that the deal is on, and this is the last step, essentially. And so John was asked two questions about where he lived and in 1986 and what company he worked for. He answered both questions correctly. After the proof of life questions, they put the ski mask back on and they took off back down the river. John didn't know what this meant. They said, "Okay, the negotiations are going well. Just hold tight." Sure enough, that night, the captors went to the six hostages and told them to get ready. That they were planning the rendezvous. They were planning the money drop. And now if all went to plan, it was going to be simply a financial transaction. They were going to throw the hostages into the boats. They were going to take them to a landing in Port Harcourt. The hostages were going to get out, and they were going to be given a bag of money, and everyone was going to go on their merry ways. But just to make sure, the captors prepared as if they were going to war. Now, these are all people from the Ija community, and so they believe in the Ija god of war. His name is Igbesu. And so in order to honor Igbesu, they paint their face with white paint. They put red ribbons around their arms, and they all douse themselves as they're getting into the boats with a concoction that's based with a palm oil concoction. And all of the gunmen are getting droplets of this on their bodies. They're going in, stepping into the boat, and John steps into the boat and looks at the man standing there with a bucket and a little stick that he's using to spray everyone. And John says, "Well, what is that?" And he explains that this is a potion they believe that keeps bullets away and makes you immune from bullets. And John's got a really dry sense of humor, and he says, "Can we get some?" the guy says, "Yeah, sure." And so they go ahead and they douse the six hostages. And John says, "What happens? What if it doesn't work? What if we get a bullet?" And the guy looks at him and says, "Well, if you get hit and you start bleeding, then it means you just didn't believe properly." And so, within an hour or two, they got to the rendezvous point. There were no guns were fired except just in the air as the kidnappers were sort of trying to prevent any funny business at the last minute. So as the hostages were getting out of the boat and climbing up onto this landing and running to this land cruiser that was waiting a few hundred yards away, the kidnappers are firing up in the air just to create a sense of chaos. And that was it. So then John, that was John's 10-day spell as a hostage.
Do you know what it cost to get him back, what the ransom was?
According to him, there were two ransoms paid. Apparently the first ransom was about $300,000, but it had, quote-unquote, gone missing. And the second ransom, which actually resulted in their freedom, was another $300,000.
Do you know what he meant by gone missing?
The suggestion was that there was corruption involved and that, like I said, $300,000 had been sanctioned by someone. This was in the early days, so this could have actually been sanctioned by the insurance company. And then the Nigerian government could have said, "We don't know what happened to the money that you gave us yesterday." Or it could have been sanctioned by the Nigerian federal government, and the state government could have said, "We don't know what happened to the money that happened yesterday." But all told, approximately $600,000 were paid out.
I can imagine if I had a relative in a foreign country who was kidnapped, I would be hysterical. I would imagine that relatives may want to fly to the capital and get deeply involved. How do the consultants deal with family members? Do they tell them to stay away? Do they have techniques for calming them?
That's a great question. The consultancies, particularly the bigger consultancies that have multiple consultants working each case, will oftentimes have a consultant, say, back in Houston, Texas, that's working with that is keeping both headquarters in Houston, Texas, and keeping also the family calm. And then they'll also have another consultant who's say in Lagos, Nigeria, or Port Harcourt, who's working the case, working the negotiation side of it a little bit closer. It is a concern, and as one of the consultants said to me, it's when the gunshots go off in the background on the phone, and that's their way. I mean, in Somalia, the gunshots will go off, and that's the equivalent of say the Mexicans cutting someone's fingers off. He said that's gut check time, and that's when you as a consultant have to be able to keep everyone calm. And I don't think there were any secret techniques, or at least none that they shared with me. But that's the balance is keeping everyone's emotions in check. And remembering that while this is a life that we're trying to get out, you have to boil down that life to being a commodity, and you have to be realize that you're bartering for, you know, you're just bartering for a commodity.
You mentioned that you spent some time with this veteran kidnapper in Nigeria. How did you make that kind of contact?
Well, so this guy's name is Adeyele Nwezi, and he had become, according to the police chief in Port Harcourt, the main city where we were spending most of our time, he'd become the most wanted kidnapper in March and April. He'd been on the run from the government. He had, been hiding. No one knew where he was. And then in early August, the Nigerian government announced an amnesty for militants that had been fighting against the government in the Niger Delta region over the past several years. And the first people to enter this amnesty, embrace this amnesty, and turn in their weapons and declare that they sort of wanted to take the true path were oftentimes just simply criminals, such as my friend Adeyele Nwezi. He, about 10 days after the amnesty began, he went to the government and said, okay, you know, I'm ready to come in, but I want to be assured that I'm not going to be killed or prosecuted. And so this was the arrangement. Now, he was being held in a but he was also very angry. He was angry. He said that the terms of the amnesty hadn't been met. He wasn't getting the stipend that he had promised him, and that he still they promised to rebuild his house, and it was still laying and totally destroyed. So he was willing to talk, and we my fixer was a fantastic guy, and he'd been able to get in touch with him. And we went to a military safe house one afternoon, and the military oddly let us sit there and interview this guy for an hour. And he told us all about how he got into the industry, what he'd been, you know, who he'd kidnapped, how he'd kidnapped them, the kind of money he'd made, what he did with the money. And it was just – it was an amazing story. And you realize the extent to which this has become institutionalized, because his lawyer who was standing next to him, and his lawyer's name was, no joke, Innocent. And so as Innocent is standing there sort of watching the discussion, you know, Innocent is saying, you know, I would advise you not to go into detail on that or not to say that. And I thought, this is unreal. And so Innocent is like, you know, the kidnapper's lawyer. And it was really – it was quite a scene.
You also spoke to a young kidnapper who maybe in the lower end of the trade. His name was Didan, right?
That's exactly. He wanted to be called – that was his nom de guerre. He said, you know, call me Didan.
And how was his tale different?
His tale was different in that he wasn't as ruthless. He had a college degree. He had just graduated with a degree in political science a couple of years earlier. He told me that his favorite book was Machiavelli's The Prince. But there are cults on Nigerian campuses, and he belonged to this cult called the Greenlanders. And Didan, after he graduated, couldn't find a job as a political scientist and went back to his alumni network. And a couple of these Greenlanders were living in a camp, and they had been involved in kidnappings. And one thing led to another, and before Didan knew it, there were no options, and he and his buddies had formed a kidnapping syndicate and were running around kidnapping people, including 7-year-old kids.
But at a lower level, right? I mean, he didn't do Westerners, right?
And he didn't do Westerners, but he never had the chance, and he just didn't have the sophistication. He admitted. He said, you know, that we know that Westerners, and he said, you know, we know that white men are where the money is. So he was focusing on easy prey, older men that came from landed money, kids that they could easily grab and then be able to ransom off. And, you know, and he said that the ransoms that they received were in the tens of thousands, nothing, you know, like the hundreds of thousands of dollars that Nwezi was making.
Were there ways that you took special precautions, given what you learned about this issue when you were abroad and reporting it?
Well, over the course of the 2 years that I lived in Pakistan, where toward the end of my stay in late 2007, kidnapping was becoming a concern, and then I went back to Pakistan for a few weeks to do a reporting in August of 2008, and became more of a concern, particularly when stories started appearing in the press that I had been kidnapped when I actually hadn't been kidnapped. I kind of leave a paper trail, and we'll try and notify both family and stay very in close contact with editors. And on this trip, I was in contact every day with my editor, sending him a text message or an email right around 8 or 9 p.m. Nigerian time, as I was sort of turning in for the day and I was at my hotel, saying my location, the time, you know, how everything was going, etc. And at least that way, should something go wrong, everyone, you know, your last location is known much more accurately than just kind of disappearing for 3 weeks to go report a story.
Nicholas Schmidl, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on, Dave.
Nicholas Schmidl spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Schmidl's article on the kidnapping and ransom industry was published in this week's New York Times Sunday Magazine. Dave Davies is a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Clint Eastwood and Morgan Freeman have just made their third film together. We're going to talk with them about working together. Eastwood directed and starred with Morgan Freeman in the films Unforgiven and Million Dollar Baby. Morgan Freeman plays Nelson Mandela in the new film Invictus, which is directed by Eastwood. The story is about how, after the end of apartheid, President Mandela tried to unite blacks and whites around rugby on the assumption that a winning team could inspire the country and bring it together. In this scene, the leadership of the ANC, the African National Congress, which had led the resistance against apartheid, has just voted to change the team's name, emblem, and colors, which they'd considered symbols from the apartheid era. President Mandela sees that as a divisive move and rushes to their meeting to convince them to reverse their vote.
I believe we should restore the Springboks. Restore their name, their emblem, and their colors immediately. Our enemy is no longer the Afrikaner. They are our fellow South Africans, our partners in democracy. And they treasure Springbok rugby. If we take that away, we lose them. I know. All of the things they denied us. But this is no time to celebrate petty revenge. This is the time to build our nation. You elected me your leader. Let me lead you now.
Morgan Freeman as Nelson Mandela in a scene from the new film Invictus. Freeman told me that years ago Mandela had said if anyone were to portray him in a film, it should be Morgan Freeman. Freeman was able to spend some time with Mandela to prepare to play him. What are some of the things you learned about him as a man by watching him?
I don't think I learned anything that really stands out that much. So I was watching nuance all the time, and I don't think I found anything that just like, oh, gee, what a surprise that is. I don't think that ever happened.
Let's get into some of the nuance then. What did you learn just about his posture and his style of speaking?
Well, at this age, he doesn't quite stand straight. I mean, he's an erect man, but if you tried to mimic his posture, you would fold just a little bit. That's one thing. He has a kind of flat-footed walk. It's not very flat-footed because he used to be a boxer, and but he's got a bad leg. And I think that's what occasions the kind of way he walks. And he has certain little tics and quirks that I can't tell you about, but I could show you.
So there are a lot of rugby scenes in the film as the team prepares and as they, you know, work their way toward the World Cup and through the World Cup. So Clint Eastwood, you had to figure out ways of shooting those scenes, and it's actually a pretty violent looking sport. I'm incredibly unfamiliar with rugby, but it looks a little bit like football with different rules, but no protective gear. There's no helmet. There's no padding. I mean, the players are basically wearing shorts and T-shirts.
Well, it is a rough sport, probably. Among the roughest. It's because of those things you just got through mentioning, the lack of equipment and what have you. There's a lot of muscle and a lot of effort exerted on the field. You don't have separate teams that come in like American football. You play the whole game. There's a lot of different rules to it, but it is an exciting game to watch. Because of the pictures seen through Mandela's office and his associates who think he's doing the wrong thing by embracing this team, the Springbok team had not played an international game in many years due to boycotting apartheid, that they were not favored to do anything. The only reason they were in the playoffs was because it was the host nation. And so that gave them a shot at it. But then they had to play some very strong teams, ending up with the strongest rugby team at that particular time in history, which was the New Zealand All Blacks. And so we just tried to montage up to it, and then the final game is hangs on the cliff as to whether they win or lose the World Cup, which is a dream, of course, that Mr. Mandela counted on and defied the odds.
And won.
This is the third film that you've worked together on. You worked together on Unforgiven, in which you both starred and Clint Eastwood you directed, and in Million Dollar Baby. And again, you were both starring and Clint Eastwood you directed that. How did you first meet? Did you meet each other before making those movies?
No, we actually met on the set of Unforgiven. It was the first time I'd ever gotten up close and personal with him. I remember being in Zimbabwe working on a picture, and I got a call from my agent that Clint wanted me to be in his Western, and I was almost floored with the surprise. And, you know, he's probably one of my favorite Western actors of all time, and one of my favorite movies of all time is The Outlaw Josie Wales, which was his, and now he's calling me to come and be in one with him. Life couldn't get better.
So let's hear a scene from Unforgiven. And this is a movie in which Clint Eastwood and Morgan Freeman both play retired gunslingers who agree to take on one last job, and the job is to find whoever it was who slashed the face of a prostitute in another town, and other prostitutes in that town have put their money together to pay a reward for whoever, you know, avenges this crime. And so you've very reluctantly agreed to do it. You've really given up your guns. You this is something you don't want to do, but you do it. So here you are on your way to this job, and you're sitting around a campfire talking.
Ned, you remember that drover I shot through the mouth? His teeth came out the back of his head. I think about him now and again. He didn't do anything to deserve to get shot. At least nothing I could remember when I sobered up.
He was one crazy sumbitch, Will.
Yeah, no one liked me, and the boys all thought I was going to shoot him out of pure meanness.
Well, you ain't like that no more.
Eagle, he hated my guts. Bonaparte didn't think too much of me either.
Quincy neither, right?
No. Quincy used to just watch all the time. Scared.
Well, like I said, I ain't like that no more.
It's my guest, Clint Eastwood and Morgan Freeman in a scene from Unforgiven. Morgan Freeman, what's it like to be directed by Clint Eastwood?
Hard to explain because you're not directed by Clint Eastwood. If you if you're lucky enough to get a job with him, you're allowed to work. He doesn't hire you to say, okay, now this is what I want you to do. He hires you, and you've read the script, and if you think you can do it, and you're left alone to do it. For me, that's very as close to heaven as you can get.
One of the things he's famous for is for not saying action, so as to not have this like clearly delineated line. And maybe I'm misrepresenting this, so stop me if I'm wrong. And also to just kind of maintain the quiet and the mood that you want in your mind and not holler action. Clint Eastwood, stop me if I'm misrepresenting you.
Okay.
Am I close here? I should let you explain it and then ask Morgan Freeman what it's like to not hear action.
Well, you hire people because you think they're either really close to the part, or you admire their talent and you figure that they're going to bring to they're obviously, you don't hire them because they're dummies. You hire them because you figure they understand the script certainly as well as you do. And then I suppose if somebody forgets something or leaves something out, you remind them about it. And if you want a little more dynamics, a little more speed in the scene, or a little this and that, you make those suggestions, but you're not going to be giving acting lessons. That's something you can't do. There's no director on the planet, never has been, that's going to be able to stop a production and start from scratch. That's why you hire professional people. And if you're a good casting person, which I believe I am, I like to think I am, you get people that you know can deliver. Morgan Freeman would be probably the ultimate example.
And in terms of not saying action?
Not saying action is something I learned years ago from working on Rawhide series, and I'd have various directors come in every week with new episodes, and they'd all love to scream action at the top of their lungs. And we found that it not only kept the set rather noisy because everybody felt they had to scream, but then the horses would go crazy. They'd go all different directions. And they'd line up, four of us, and we'd ride up to the camera, and the director would yell, action, and the horses would go every which way. And the actors would either fall on the ground or be hanging on for dear life. And finally, one day I said to a director, a television director at that time, I said, how about just not saying action? Maybe the horse is so used to hearing it that it unnerves him, or gets him anxieties about going into the shot, and maybe it gives the actor a slight anxiety. Maybe they just grip the horse subtly, but a little stronger than they should. And so in order to keep things to calm down, I said, why don't you just wave at us? Just wave, come on in, you know. And so, or use the words, come on in, or what have you. So that kind of, I found that worked very well, and I found it worked even when you don't have horses, because people, sometimes with kids and stuff, I'll just start the camera and not even tell them I'm starting it, because you want people to come in with a relaxed atmosphere. Now, the scene may not be relaxed, but the objective of the scene, but you want the work mechanism to be relaxed.
Morgan Freeman, do you feel less anxiety because Clint Eastwood doesn't holler action when a scene starts?
Well, I feel less anxiety because Clint Eastwood is the one behind the camera. I'm just amused by the fact that he doesn't call action. He doesn't call anything, and he never says cut. I never once heard him say cut at any time. He says things like, okay, that's enough, or stop, or, well, I guess that'll do.
Or that's about as good as it's going to get, I guess.
Not as good as you're going.
Let me move on to another movie that you made together, and this is Million Dollar Baby. And let me play a scene. And in this movie, Clint Eastwood stars as a former, would you call him a boxing coach, boxing manager? What's the right word?
A manager and coach.
Okay.
He owns a small gym.
Now he owns a small, like, run-down gym in downtown L.A.
Yeah, exactly.
And Morgan Freeman is a former boxer who now cleans the gym and helps run it. And he lost an eye in a fight while the Clint Eastwood character was his coach, urging him to stop the fight. But Morgan Freeman didn't stop the fight, and that ended his career. In the movie, a young woman played by Hilary Swank wants desperately to be coached by the Clint Eastwood character. He turns her down, but finally agrees and becomes a kind of father surrogate to her. In this scene, Hilary Swank is fighting, and her manager, Clint Eastwood, isn't managing her at this moment, and her manager is incompetent. So Eastwood kind of comes into the ring, takes over, and is in her corner. We hear him talking with her. And then we hear a voiceover from Morgan Freeman, and Morgan Freeman's character narrates the story. So here's the scene.
I keep holding my left up, boss. Then I throw a punch and it keeps dropping.
Yeah, well, let it drop.
That'd be a lot easier.
She thinks she knows you, that's all. Every time you drop it, she comes right over the top. So you just wait for her, see? That's all she's thinking about. And when she cocks that big right hand, you hear me?
I hear you, boss.
And when she does, you step to the side and come over with this big good night hook. You got one?
Got it right here.
Okay.
Fight or I'm calling it.
Go give it to her.
The body knows what fighters don't. How to protect herself. A neck can only twist so far. Twist it just a hair more. And the body says, hey, I'll take it from here. Because you obviously don't know what you're doing.
See the way she did that?
Yeah.
Sugar Ray would do that. Girl's got sugar.
Lie down now. Rest. And we'll talk about this when you regain your senses. It's called the knockout mechanism.
Don't get all carried away.
It's the scene from Million Dollar Baby with my guests Clint Eastwood and Morgan Freeman, as well as Hilary Swank. Morgan Freeman, you know, part of your role in this is to be the narrator, to do the voiceover, and to tell the story, and to do it in the kind of voice that you can kind of read between the lines of, because there's mysteries here in the story as you tell it. Can you talk a little bit about doing the voiceover in the film?
Well, I think we did that in about an hour, right?
Mm-hmm.
We went into a makeshift studio, and I had the script, and we just laid it down sort of like a timing track. And I always watch Clint get this voice that he uses in the movies. So I decided on this one, I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to get a Clint Eastwood voice. So I did. I just made it about as raspy as I could finally get it. And that was, I liked the quality of that voice.
Clint Eastwood, did you know that that's what he was doing, trying to capture your voice?
No, I don't know too much about what he was doing. I got this idea. We had a little hour break because of a mechanical problem. So there was a guest house in this house we were shooting. So we stepped out of there. I said, let's go do this narration. So we went out in the guest house and set it up with a sound guy, brought his equipment out there, and we knocked out the whole picture, the whole narration for the picture. But it sounded great to me. I think he's got a wonderful sound anyway, no matter what picture he's in. He always has this wonderful speaking voice. But he's also playing Scrap Iron, a guy who's been beaten around pretty much, as has Frankie, the character I played. So they're both old gummers, so to speak, and they're and they it seemed like the right tone at the right time.
And Morgan Freeman, when the director of a film is also the star of the film, as Clint Eastwood was in Unforgiven and Million Dollar Baby, does it complicate things for you as the actor? You know, when your director is actually not behind the camera, but he's in the scene with you.
No, it only complicated things for me when we were doing Unforgiven, because and this happened one time I never forget. We were filming. It was night. It was I think we had rain towers, and it was very cold, and it was raining. And we were both wet, but we'd finish a scene. I'd be sent inside to the heat, and Clint would be outside setting up the next shot, and I began to worry about him. So other than that, no, I don't have any reaction to him being the star of the movie and then behind the camera, too. Again, this goes back to this whole thing of the quality of the set. It's always... it always runs smoothly, so it's not like he had bit off more than he could chew, which you can see sometimes.
I'm just flattered that he was worried about
it. Did you tell Clint Eastwood you were worried about him? And I imagine you were worried he was going to get sick.
Well, I expressed some solicitude about his well-being during all that, but, you don't go up to Clint Eastwood and say, hey, listen, why don't you sit down for a while?
Yeah. I was a much younger man then, too.
Is that true, too?
Thank you both so much for talking with us.
Good to talk to you, Terry, again.
Nice talking to you, Terry.
Clint Eastwood directed the new film Invictus, which stars Morgan Freeman as Nelson Mandela. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says two kinds of people consume Christmas music, those who actually like the stuff and folks who need something listenable on hand in case seasonal visitors request some ornamental mood music. For both groups, he reviews two new jazz brass albums, Holiday Cheer with a Twist.
Carla Bley's version of A Christmas Tune We Don't Need to Identify, showing how a wrong note in the right place can make all the difference. Her album, Carla's Christmas Carols, is sometimes sweetly and majestically unironic. But the odd bits give it a sense of mystery that suits the holy day, but is rare in Christmas music. It might have been the year's weirdest Yuletide disc, if not for Bob Dylan. Christmas music often features brass ensembles. It takes trumpets to announce the arrival of a king. Most of Bley's arrangements feature a brass quintet. On Jingle Bells, you can just about see the horse pull that sleigh. Sometimes, that classical brass quintet is joined or replaced by Carla Bley's piano and Steve Swallow's improbably tuneful electric bass. Bley is celebrated as a composer, but doesn't get her due as a witty and economical pianist in the tradition of Basie and Monk. Carla Bley shows she can play the wrong right notes as well as the right wrong ones. She often balances lyricism and silliness like that. The way she walks a line between honest sentiment and amused attachment suggests one way to cope with the season. The album to put on after hers is trumpeter Eddie Allen's Jazzy Brass for the Holidays. His tongue-in-cheek sensibility can be a lot like Bley's, but his arrangements for four brass plus bass and drums are bluesier and swing harder. Eddie Allen with brother Carl Allen on drums. Eddie had played in Lester Bowie's drum and bugle corps Brass Fantasy, so he knows how to blow raspberries at old favorites. Trombonist Clark Gayton is right with him on that. It's not like Eddie Allen's sextet makes a joke out of everything. Jazz musicians interpret unlikely material all the time and are no strangers to serious playing on light themes. Here's the band's other top trumpeter, Cecil Bridgewater. Let It Snow. Good as these two brass albums are, the gold standard for jazz Christmas music remains Billy Strayhorn's revamps of The Nutcracker on the Duke Ellington CD Three Sweets. But you can't listen to that all week. Besides which, Eddie Allen's sextet makes those shop-worn Xmas tunes so shiny you can forget you're listening to Christmas music and think you're just listening to music.
Kevin Whitehead teaches at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed Carla's Christmas Carols by Carla Bley and Jazzy Brass for the Holidays by Eddie Allen.